about the potential pitfalls. If this cruise didn't perform as advertised, there could be some serious repercussions. Why wasn't someone from the FBI sent in? Why didn't they wait to see if they could get more hostages released? The questions would go on and on. Baxter saw a risk. Hell, the whole thing was a risk. And his political instincts told him to protect himself. After another minute of thought, Baxter decided to walk that thin line again. The vice president came back over and sat. "Director Stansfield, I have given you," Baxter paused, searching for the most innocuous word, "permission to collect intelligence in this matter. What you choose to do specifically is up to you. I don't need to be kept in the loop for every decision along the way." Stansfield, an expert at interpreting political speak, understood the vice president clearly. It was another Iran-Contra. Baxter wanted Stansfield and the CIA to stick their necks out, and if things fell apart, he would have his plausible denial. Stansfield looked at Baxter and nodded his understanding. There would be time to handle these details at a later point. For now, they needed to get the ball rolling. Baxter continued, "I'm reluctant to do anything until Aziz releases his next set of demands, which of course will be tomorrow morning. If we can exchange more hostages for money, I'm inclined to do it."
"Sir," said Kennedy, "if I may be frank, I don't think he's going to keep asking for money."
"What do you think he will ask for?"
Stansfield leaned forward and fielded the question.
"That is anyone's guess."
The director of the CIA wasn't about to divulge his ace in the hole, their custody of Farah Harut, especially to someone like Baxter.
"But I would agree with Irene."
Baxter pondered what the next demand might be, and then turned his attention back to the matter at hand.
"Who knows about your plans for Mr. Cruz?"
"General Flood, a select few others at the Pentagon, and us."
"No one at the FBI?" Baxter repeated.
"No."
"For now, I think you should go about collecting your intelligence independent of the FBI. They have enough to worry about."
Stansfield again read between the lines and nodded. The FBI was to be kept in the dark about RAP. More proof that the vice president wanted to insulate himself from any potential disaster. Baxter looked at Stansfield and asked,
"Is that all?"
"Yes, I think so."
"Good. Thank you for keeping us informed."
Baxter motioned for the door.
"Now, if you'll excuse us, I need to get ready to address the nation."
Stansfield and Kennedy stood and started for the door. As they neared it, Vice President Baxter called out,
"If you decide to send your man in, please keep him on a short leash."
Stansfield gave his silent answer with a nod, then followed Kennedy into the hallway. Chapter 20. They hit the first checkpoint 3 blocks away from the White House. A quarter of a moon shone in the night sky, and not a cloud was in sight. Rapp was riding in the back seat of the long black Suburban with Milt Adams. Lieutenant Commander Harris of SEAL Team 6 was in the passenger seat, and Chief Petty Officer Mick Reavers was driving. Following the Suburban through the checkpoints were a plain blue van and a larger black box van. Lieutenant Commander Harris handled the D.C. Metro Police at the first 2 checkpoints and then the Secret Service agents at the last checkpoint. Word had been sent down from on high that the CIA was moving in some sensitive equipment to conduct surveillance. Approaching the White House from the east, they pulled through the last checkpoint at Pennsylvania Avenue and 15th Street. Reavers, the large linebacker type that had been along on the mission to grab Harut, drove the Suburban onto Hamilton Place and continued past the southern edge of the Treasury Building. The White House was now in sight, ahead and to the right, the top floor of the mansion visible above the trees. On the right was the entrance to the underground parking garage that the terrorists had used just yesterday to assault and take the White House. A white Suburban was now parked at the top of the ramp, blocking its use. Straight ahead was a closed gate that led onto the south grounds of the White House. Reavers extinguished the headlights and turned left onto East Executive Avenue. Continuing south for another 50 feet, Reavers took a hard right at the direction of Milt Adams and pulled up on the curb, the front grille of the truck stopping inches from the heavy black fence. As had already been decided, the blue van backed up onto the curb about 20 feet to the north of the Suburban and stopped with its rear bumper almost touching the fence. The large black box van parked on the street right in between the two vehicles, creating a space in the middle that would shield the men from prying eyes. Doors began to open, and bodies piled out of all three vehicles. Everyone, even Milt Adams, was dressed in the standard black Nomex jumpsuits worn by Navy SEALs. Three of Harris's SEALs set up a security perimeter on the outside of the vehicles, while four more unfurled a massive black tarp. In a little over a minute, they had the tarp stretched over the top of all three vehicles and secured. With the tarp in place, two of the men went to work on the fence. With a small handheld hydraulic jack, they began prying apart the vertical bars so Rapp and Adams could pass through. Harris and Rapp approached the fence and tried to spy a look at the roof of the White House. The trees and undergrowth between them and the residence were dense, hopefully dense enough to conceal their movements. Harris raised his small, secure Motorola radio to his mouth and asked, "Slick, what do you got for me?" Lying on his belly less than a block away, Charlie Wicker peered through a pair of night vision binoculars. Wicker was set up on the backside of the pitched roof of the Treasury building. Arriving 30 minutes in advance of the others, he had been watching the terrorist sitting atop the roof of the White House trying to discern any patterns. Wicker lowered the lip mic on his headset and said, "He has no idea you're there. He spends most of his time looking west over at that ugly building on the other side of the White House." "Good," replied Harris. "Anything else to report?" Wicker squinted as he looked at the hooded man no more than 150 feet away. The only thing separating them was a half-inch of bulletproof plexiglass. "Yeah, I think I can take this guy out with a pair of 50s. Wicker was referring to a 50-caliber sniping rifle. The heavy-caliber weapon was used by Special Forces snipers to take out targets at distances exceeding a mile. "I'll keep that in mind. Let me know if he starts looking our way. Over." Harris turned to Rapp. "So far, so good." "Good." Rapp led the way, and he, Harris, and Adams walked over to the blue van. The side cargo doors were open, revealing an array of equipment stacked in electronic racks, or, as the man sitting behind the main console called them, pizza racks. Marcus Dumond was a 26-year-old computer genius and almost convicted felon. Rapp had brought Dumond into the fold at Langley 3 years earlier. The young cyber genius had run into some trouble with the feds while he was earning his master's degree in computer science at MIT. He was alleged to have hacked into one of New York's largest banks and then transferred funds into several overseas accounts. The part that interested the CIA was that Dumond wasn't caught because he left a trail. He was caught because he got drunk one night and bragged about his financial plunders to the wrong person. At the time, Dumond was living with Stephen Rapp, Mitch's younger brother. When the older Rapp heard about Dumond's problems with the FBI, he called Irene Kennedy and told her the hacker was worth a look. Langley doesn't like to admit that they employ some of the world's best computer pirates, but these young cyber geeks were encouraged to hack into any and every computer system they can. Most of these hacking raids are directed at foreign companies, banks, governments, and military computer systems. But just getting into a system isn't enough. The challenge is to hack in, get the information, and get out without leaving a trace that the system was ever compromised. The wiry Marcus Dumond poked his head out the open door, a cigarette hanging from his mouth, and a pair of thick glasses perched on his nose.
"Commander Harris, can you tell your men to cut a hole in the tarp? I have to raise my communications boom."
Harris turned to one of his nearby men and told him to cut the hole. Dumond then stepped out of the van with a large fanny pack. Over by the box van, a long folding table had been set up, and a series of blueprints and schematics were being taped to the side of the van. Portable red filter lights provided limited lighting and gave everyone's face an eerie, sallow look. Setting the pack atop the table, Dumont opened it and extracted a small black object. Holding it in front of Rapp, Harris, and finally Adams, he said,
"Micro Video and Audio Surveillance Unit. You guys have both used these, right?"
Rapp and Harris nodded. The objects were about an inch and a half thick, about 4 inches long, and about 3 inches across. At the top of the unit was a small, thin bump about the size of a pen tip. The tiny, highly sensitive microphone was encased in black foam. Next to it was a thin 3-inch fiber optic cord, at the end of which was a tiny lens. Dumond turned to Adams.
"These little babies have two settings, regular and pulse. The regular will last about 3 days, and the pulse will give you almost 12. The pulse still supplies full audio, but only gives a snapshot every 5 seconds."
Dumond shrugged his shoulders.
"It's up to you guys how you want to use them, but I would suggest a little of both, just in case."
Flipping the small unit over, Dumond said,
"I've attached Velcro to the back of every unit. Here," Dumond picked up a plastic bag, "are the corresponding Velcro patches. I've also thrown in these little alcohol wipes to clean the surface before you attach the Velcro patch, especially if you're in a place where there's a lot of dust, like a ventilation duct. I've packed 12 black and 12 white units."
Dumond turned to Rapp.
"You know the routine. Install them at choke points in areas of high traffic. I can maneuver the cameras a little bit from remote, but I advise against it. It burns a lot of juice. So try to give us a good angle when you set them up. Any questions?"
Dumond paused, giving them a chance, and then said,
"Good. Let's check your communications and get you on your way."
Dumond led the three men over to the blue van and retrieved 2 secure radios and headsets. Dumond had already checked out the units on the way over from Langley. Turning Adams around, Dumond placed the radio in a specially designed pocket that sat just above his left shoulder blade. Dumond then placed the headset on Adams and showed him how to adjust the lip mic. In the meantime, Rapp placed his radio in his vest and turned his black baseball cap backward. Over the top of the cap, he secured the headset and checked the mic with Harris. After they were positive the units worked properly, Dumond cautioned,
"I'm probably going to lose you guys as you go through the tunnel. The jammer they are using to black out the president's bunker is creating a dead zone. All our sensors tell us that the interference dissipates as you reach the upper levels of the mansion. So, I want you to come up to the second floor as quickly as you can and reestablish radio contact."
Dumond reached back into the van and grabbed another pack.
"I'm also going to give you this secure field radio. It has more range and power, and I put some extra radio batteries in here just in case."
Dumond held up a small black nylon pack. Rapp looked at the radio pack and started to wonder if he'd be able to carry all of the equipment through the shaft. Then, responding to Dumond's statement, Rapp replied, "We'll try to get to the second floor, but I can't promise anything until I get in there and see what they have. If everything is booby-trapped, we might not even get out of the basement."
"I'll get us out of the basement," Adams said confidently.
Rapp took the second pack from Dumond and asked, "Anything else for us?"
"Nope."
Dumond stuck out his fist, and Rapp did the same. Banging Rapp's once on top and once on the bottom, Dumond said,
"Good luck, Mitch."
Then, looking to Adams, he said,
"Try and keep this guy out of trouble, will you?"
"I will," Adams smiled.
Rapp thanked Dumond and grabbed Adams. As they walked back over to the Suburban, Rapp's thoughts turned to something he'd been debating for most of the day. The question was whether to arm Adams with a weapon. Rapp's concern was not whether Adams could shoot straight enough to hit anything, but whether he would accidentally shoot Rapp in the back. It was no small concern, considering the fact that the Special Forces community rarely went a year without someone accidentally getting shot, and those people were cream of the crop. With reservation, Rapp asked,
"Milt, what do you think about bringing a gun with you, just in case?"
Adams reached into his pocket and pulled out a .357 revolver.
"I already have one."
Surprised, Rapp extended his hand.
"May I?"
Adams handed him the gun, and Rapp immediately recognized it as a Ruger Speed 6. Before automatics became all the rage with cops, the Speed 6 was a popular, dependable gun for a lot of police departments. The barrel was short, making it easy to draw, and since it was a revolver, jamming was not an issue. Rapp considered for a moment if he should give Adams one of his own silenced weapons, and then decided against it. He would just as soon have Adams use a gun he was comfortable with. Besides, if it ever got to the point where Adams had to start shooting, they'd already be well past the point of stealth. Rapp handed him the gun back and asked, "Do you want a holster?" Adams shook his head. "Nah, I'm used to carrying it in my pocket." "All right." Rapp stood awkwardly for a second, looking down at the tiny Adams, wondering if he really knew what he was getting himself into. Adams sensed Rapp's mood. "Don't worry about me, Mitch. I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think it was the right thing." Rapp smiled and nodded with more respect than Adams could have guessed. "The right thing," he thought to himself. What a difference between his generation and Milt's. Rapp took the next 5 minutes to get his gear together. With all of his weapons, communications equipment, surveillance equipment, and some limited rations, his gear weighed more than 75 pounds. Because of the tight space of the shaft, he and Harris had decided it would be best if he towed it behind him with a rope. Finally, with all of their equipment assembled, Rapp, Adams, and Harris waited at the fence line for the green light. In a windowless room on the 7th floor of the main building at Langley, a select few had gathered to monitor the progress of Mitch Rapp and Milt Adams. The room was strikingly similar to a television network control booth. On the main wall was a bank of 19-inch monitors, 4 rows of them running 10 across. In front of the monitors, at a slightly elevated table, sat 4 technicians. At their disposal was the latest in video production equipment. Behind them, and elevated still further, sat Dr. Irene Kennedy, General Campbell, and several of their assistants. The work surface at this level was cluttered with phones and computers. At the 3rd level sat Director Stansfield, General Flood, Colonel Bill Gray, and Admiral DeVoe. The 4th and last row was occupied by a half dozen other high-ranking Pentagon and CIA officials. Conveniently absent from the group was any representative from the FBI, something that Irene Kennedy did not like. The 4 monitors in the bottom left corner were showing the networks and CNN preparing for the Vice President's national address. 10 of the monitors, just above the bottom 4, showed different shots of the White House's exterior. 1 was zoomed in on the terrorist sitting in the rooftop guard booth, and the others were either trained on specific doors and windows or general areas. The remaining 26 monitors were pale blue with the exception of 1 near the middle. It glowed with a reddish hue, showing Rapp and the others at work in the strange red light. Irene Kennedy's hair was pulled back, and she was wearing a lightweight operator's headset, as were all of the others in the 1st 2 rows. Kennedy nodded slowly as she listened to Marcus Dumond. After a moment, she raised the arm of her headset and turned to look up at the 2 men sitting directly behind her.
"Everything is ready. They're waiting for authorization."
Stansfield and Flood looked at each other briefly, Flood nodding first and Stansfield following suit. Stansfield then looked down at Kennedy and gave his okay. The director of the CIA watched Kennedy relay the orders and wondered again if he should pick up the phone and tell FBI Director Roach what they were up to. He had in part covered himself by passing the word that they were conducting electronic surveillance, but this was much more than that. If things went bad, it could jeopardize the safety of the hostages. Chapter 21. The word was passed, and the red filter light was extinguished. The relatively cool night had turned thick and muggy under the canvas tarp. It had been decided that Rapp would go first, followed by Adams, and then Harris. Rapp felt for the slit in the tarp and pulled it to the side. taking the main pack, Rapp wedged it through the bars, and then with the smaller packs that Dumond had given him, he turned sideways and squeezed through the bent bars. Adams and Harris followed, and the three of them walked softly through the underbrush, ducking under branches and bending limbs out of their way. They were careful to stay off the paths that the Secret Service had laid out through the underbrush. The paths were designed to funnel fence jumpers into areas loaded with sensors, and although they didn't think the terrorists were using the perimeter security system, there was no sense in pushing their luck. When they reached the immediate area of the vent, Lieutenant Commander Harris whispered into his headset, "Slick, do you have any movement on the roof?" The reply came back instantly. "Nope, he's still looking to the west." There was just enough light from the street lamps for the three of them to see each other. Rapp nodded to Adams. They had both heard the same report over their headsets. Taking his signal, Adams plucked several of the fake bushes from the ground. The bushes were designed to conceal the ventilation hood during all four seasons. Adams moved the shrubs out of the way while Rapp and Harris unfolded a smaller black tarp. With the tarp in place over the top of the hood, the three men crawled under it and went to work. Rapp held a small tool pack while Harris aimed a red filter flashlight for Adams. The older man of the group started by spraying lubricant along the seam in the sheet metal. Then, with a small cordless drill, he zipped out 8 screws. Slowly, they began to wiggle the hood back and forth, trying their best to prevent the screeching of metal on metal. The lubricant diminished most of the noise, and inside of 60 seconds, they had the hood off and out of the way. Harris set up a lightweight aluminum tripod, while Rapp lowered his gear to the bottom with a climbing rope. The black tarp was thrown over the top. Harris clipped a pulley to the tripod and fed a rope through, taking one end to the fence and tying it to the winch on the front of the Suburban. Rapp stuck a small flashlight into the open shaft and looked down at the bottom. Harris returned a second later and tied the rope around Rapp's ankles, then put on a pair of gloves. Then, after grabbing the rope, he nodded to Rapp and leaned back, ready to take up the slack. Rapp gave Harris the thumbs up, and then, bending at the waist, he stuck his head in the open shaft and began to ease himself inside. Over his headset, Rapp said, "Lower me." Lieutenant Commander Harris slowly began to play out the rope until all of the slack was gone, about 8 more feet total. Harris then whispered into his headset, telling his men back at the Suburban to let the winch out. In the shaft, Rapp started his descent and turned on his small miner's lamp that was strapped over his baseball cap. As he neared the bottom, he whispered over his headset, "Stop!" Dangling like a landed catch, Rapp turned himself so he could bend at the waist and make the 90-degree turn into the shaft without breaking his back. "Okay, real slow. Let me out 4 more feet." He started to move again, and Rapp grabbed onto the sides of the horizontal vent, pulling himself inside. A bit of static crackled through his earpiece, and he said, "Stop! That's good." Rapp pulled his legs toward him, and in a sit-up-like position, he trained the miner's lamp on his feet and untied the rope around his ankles. When he was finished, he said, "Take it back up." The rope disappeared from sight, and Rapp flipped over onto his stomach. Wasting no time, he grabbed the long rope that he'd used to lower his gear into the shaft and untied it. Then, taking a short rope that he'd brought along, he tied one end to the top of his gear and the other end to his left ankle. Rolling back onto his stomach, he trained the small light down the long, narrow shaft. It looked as if it went on forever. Rapp could barely make out the turn some 200 feet away. The shaft seemed to get tighter. Rapp grimaced. He had what he liked to refer to as a healthy phobia of being trapped in places the size of a coffin. Reluctantly, Rapp started forward down the cramped space, his forearms doing most of the work. Into his lip mic he whispered, "Milt, I'm moving out." With his gear in tow, Rapp plodded forward like an alligator. The reception on his radio was becoming increasingly cluttered. Not long after they had lost contact with Rapp, Milt Adams was also lost. The only thing Kennedy and the others could do was wait. Kennedy found herself thinking that this was how the NASA mission controllers must have felt during the Apollo lunar missions. When the astronauts went around the back side of the moon, they would enter a period when communication was impossible. The room full of scientists would sit nervously at mission control and hope the spacecraft and its men would make it back around without any problems. That was the position they were in now. There was nothing they could do but wait. Kennedy took off her headset, looked up at a row of clocks on the wall to her right, and remembered there was one thing she could do. Dead in the middle of the wall was the clock noting the local time in Washington, D.C. It was almost 11 in the evening. Several clocks to the right, Kennedy found the time she was looking for. Picking up the secure phone in front of her, she dialed a number by memory. It was an important phone number. It was just before 7 in the morning in Tel Aviv, and if her counterpart wasn't in, he would be in shortly. After several clicks and whirs, someone picked up on the other end. "Fine." The word was not an answer to a question, but rather the last name of the man answering the phone, Colonel Ben Fine of the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Service, Mossad. Colonel Fine was Kennedy's direct counterpart, the man in charge of Mossad's counterterrorism section. "Ben, it's Irene Kennedy."
"Irene," said Fine excitedly. "I'm sorry I haven't called, but I figured you'd be busy."
"Have you been following the crisis?" asked Kennedy in a tired voice.
"Very closely. Is there anything I can do to help?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact, there is."
Kennedy looked down at the sheet of paper in front of her.
"I'd like you to look at a list of names for me."
"How many?"
10. "We have good intel on 7 of them, but the last 3 we've come up blank on."
Kennedy again looked at the list of names that had been provided by Dr. Hornig.
"You can count on me putting all of my resources into it. Send me the list, and I will personally make sure it gets taken care of immediately."
"Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it."
There was a pause, and then the colonel said,
"I have a question for you, as long as I've got you on the line. There have been several reports, all unconfirmed, of course, that a certain high-ranking member of Hezbollah is missing."
The Israeli colonel stopped talking for a moment and then added,
"You wouldn't know anything about this, would you?"
Kennedy lifted her eyes and looked up at the bank of television sets.
"I might have some insight into the subject."
Fine didn't reply right away. Instead, his silence conveyed an implicit tit-for-tat request.
"I assume when the time is right, you will enlighten me."
"I had planned on it," answered Kennedy honestly.
"Good,"
stated a satisfied Fine.
"Do you need anything else from me?"
Kennedy thought about it for a moment and said,
"No, not that I can think of. But anything you can do with the names would be greatly appreciated."
"I will get started right away, and do not hesitate to call if you need anything else."
"I won't. Thank you, Ben."
After setting the phone back in its cradle, Kennedy placed the list of names in a file folder and walked to the end of her row. Looking up toward the back of the room, she waved the file and caught the attention of one of her people. A man in his early 30s came down the stairs, and Kennedy handed him the file.
"Fax this to Colonel Fine immediately."
The man nodded dutifully and started back up the stairs, headed for the secure fax machine. White noise hissed through the earpiece. "I have to be near the end," Rapp thought to himself. The tunnel seemed to be getting smaller and smaller. Rapp was sweating profusely, and his heart rate was much faster than it should have been. Irritated by the noise of his radio, he reached up and took the headset off, letting it fall around his neck. He knew Milt Adams wasn't far behind because he had heard him sneezing. It must have been the thin layer of dust that lined the metal walls of the duct. There wasn't a lot of it, but Rapp himself had fought back the impulse several times. Rapp paused for a second and took in a deep breath. He lowered his sweaty head onto his arm and told himself to relax. He was expending far more energy than necessary due to his slightly panicked state. Rapp lay still for almost a minute as he got his breathing under control. His watch told him that he had been in the shaft for almost 15 minutes, longer than he had expected. It couldn't be that much farther.
After making the left turn that would take him parallel to the southern end of the mansion's foundation, he had turned the miner's light off. Rapp thought it was doubtful that anyone would be in the third basement. Aziz did not have enough men to patrol every area of the White House, but it was not worth the gamble of having the light spill through a crack or a seam in the ductwork. After several more minutes of confined crawling, Rapp reached the end. He was drenched in sweat, almost all of it from nervous energy. Gently, he let his head fall down on his arm, and he listened to make sure no one was in the boiler room. For the next 2 minutes, that was all he did. Outside the shaft, he could hear the heating, ventilation, and cooling system going through the labors of regulating the climate within the old house, but other than that, the only thing he heard was the approaching Milt Adams and his not-so-quiet sneezing. Rapp decided it was better to open the access panel before Adams and his involuntary reports arrived. He turned on his miner's lamp and ran his hand over the smooth surface of the duct until he felt a groove. Zeroing in with the light, he spotted what he was looking for. Just as Milt had said, there was an access panel right before the duct connected to the filtration system. A not-so-small wave of relief washed over him. The thought of it not being there, and having to crawl all the way back, had occurred to him several times. Before twisting the metal catches up, Rapp drew his silenced Beretta and turned off the miner's light. With the gun in his left hand, he felt for the catches with his right and turned the first one from its horizontal position to vertical. Adams had explained that the panel was attached with hinges on the bottom and two catches at the top. After twisting the second catch, he slowly allowed the panel to swing downward and looked out into the dimly lit boiler room of the White House. The ventilation duct was hung from the ceiling and ran halfway across the room, where it connected to the hulking HVAC unit that occupied the majority of the room. Poking only his head out, Rapp methodically searched the room for any signs of motion sensors or tripwires. After making sure it was safe, he pulled back into the duct and rolled over onto his back. He untied the rope around his ankle and noticed Adams crawling toward him roughly 40 feet away. Neither man spoke. Rapp had been extremely clear about that aspect of the operation. There was to be no talking unless absolutely needed. Rapp fed the loose end of the rope out of the opening, leaving several feet dangling toward the ground and the other end tied to his gear. Quickly, he scooted forward to the end of the duct, pushed himself out of the vent, and hung from his fingers, his feet dangling a little more than a foot from the ground. Gently, he let himself drop to the ground, immediately grabbed the rope, and pulled the rest of his gear down. With the pack on the ground, Rapp retrieved his silenced MP-10 submachine gun and turned on the small flashlight affixed to the underside of the barrel. If Aziz had planted any security devices, Rapp saw no sign of them. Several moments later, Milt Adams poked his sweaty, bald head out of the vent and stifled a sneeze with both hands. Rapp looked up in irritation. He set his MP-10 down and held his hands out for Adams. Adams squirmed his way out of the opening. Rapp grabbed him under the armpits and helped him down with ease. As soon as Adams's feet hit the ground, he grabbed a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his dripping nose. Rapp grabbed his submachine gun and whispered, "What's wrong?" Adams blew his nose as quietly as possible and said,
"All that dust in there, it makes my allergies act up."
Rapp frowned.
"Are you going to be all right?"
"Yeah."
Adams finished wiping his nose.
"I'll be fine."
Getting to work, Rapp opened the top of his backpack and retrieved a micro-video monitor with a directional fiber-optic cable attached to the end. They would use this to see around corners and under doors. The black-and-white monitor, which was 6 inches across by 5 inches high, was zipped into a black nylon harness. Rapp helped Adams strap it firmly between his chest and stomach, allowing the semi-rigid fiber-optic cable to hang at Adams's side. Rapp took the barrel of his silencer and stuck it under the access panel. Standing on his toes, he closed the metal panel, and with the very tip of the silencer, he pushed up one of the latches and secured it. As Rapp looked toward the door, he whispered,
"Any questions?"
"Nope."
"All right, let's move out."
Rapp walked quietly across the concrete floor to the doorway with his silenced weapon up and ready. Adams followed a step behind, and when they reached the door, he stuck the tip of the cable under the door to check to see what was on the other side. Rapp looked over his shoulder while Adams maneuvered the tip of the cable from side to side with a small dial. The coast appeared to be clear. Chapter 22. Vice President Baxter's national address had lasted less than 5 minutes. It was delivered at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, an hour later than most presidential addresses, due to the deep dissension between Baxter and King over what should be said. In the end, the speech consisted mainly of the standard condemnation of terrorism, the assurance that President Hayes was safe in his bunker, 2 minutes of nationalistic rhetoric, and, of course, a solemn plea for prayers. The early ratings were predictably high. The networks and the all-news channels were playing the crisis for everything it was worth. The newest angle they had started to play up was the theme of a government in exile. For the first time in the history of the Republic, such an address had been from the Vice President's official residence at the Naval Observatory. Dallas King stood nervously in the Vice President's study, leaning against a bookcase while he listened to a Democratic pollster explain the early results from the national address. Several other staffers were ringed around their new commander-in-chief and offered their opinions on a variety of issues. All of the camera equipment and lights had been left in place on the assumption that they would probably be needed again before the crisis was resolved. The polling numbers were awesome, but expected. Dallas King listened with feigned interest. His mind was elsewhere. King looked down at his chrome Tag Heuer watch and anxiously ran his right hand through his sun-bleached hair. He was late for a meeting he hoped would encompass both business and pleasure. The handsome chief of staff didn't like the idea of leaving Baxter alone with the other staffers, but it was unavoidable. He shifted his weight away from the bookcase and started for the other side of the study, his black cap-toed shoes marking his steps on the spotless hardwood floor. When King reached a well-worn Persian rug, he reached out and snatched his sport coat from the back of an old wooden chair. Vice President Baxter folded his arms across his small belly and smoothed an errant strand of his slicked back hair.
"Where are you headed?"
"I have some business I need to take care of." King winked at his boss as he casually draped the coat over his left shoulder. The wink was a signal that they could discuss his activities when they were alone. Baxter nodded, and Dallas moved for the door, saying, "I'll see you in the morning. If anything comes up, you can reach me on my cell."
With that, King opened the door, nodded to the two Secret Service agents posted in the hallway, and walked out across the large porch with a lively spring in his step. His metallic blue BMW convertible was parked backed into its space next to a large black Secret Service Suburban. King threw his coat onto the passenger seat and jumped in behind the wheel. He started the car and reached for the button to lower the top, and then decided he should wait until he made it through the gauntlet of reporters at the front gate. He nosed the little sports car out of the spot and gunned it down the hill for the main gate. King flashed his brights twice to make sure the Secret Service officers knew he was coming. By the time he reached the gate, it had already begun to open. Instead of using his brakes, King shifted the car back into first gear and deftly released the clutch. The low-slung car growled as it slowed, and then, when there was just enough room to make it through the opening, he shifted into second and hit the accelerator. The large tract of land, almost twice the area of the White House grounds, was besieged by the media. The main gate off Massachusetts Avenue was crowded with news trucks pulled haphazardly onto the curb, and the reporters and cameramen tried frantically to get a photo of King's car as it sped past. King kept his foot on the gas as the car shot onto Massachusetts Avenue, the Secret Service stopping traffic in both directions. He raced northward up the avenue. King checked his rearview mirror and cranked the stereo. 4 blocks north of the observatory and out of sight of the main gate, he yanked the car back into second gear and turned hard to the right, the wide tires of the BMW squealing into a 100-degree turn onto Garfield. King floored it through the residential neighborhood at speeds approaching 70 miles per hour. At 29th Street, he took a hard right turn, and one block later at Calvert, he slowed to about 10 miles per hour, paid no heed to the stop sign before him, and shot out in front of an approaching cab. The wild maneuver solicited both the horn and the finger from the cabbie. King ignored both as he raced through the light at Connecticut and crossed over into the Adams Morgan neighborhood. He was late, and the woman he was meeting would not be happy. King took another hard turn at 18th Street and slowed his speed as he entered one of the most congested areas in town. Two blocks later, he pulled up in front of Stone's, a posh, hot new bar. King stopped the car and yanked up the emergency brake just as a valet appeared at his door. Grabbing his black sport coat, he handed the man a $10 bill and said, "Keep it close." Standing just inside the door was an Asian woman in a body-hugging red dress with a slit that seemed to run from the floor to her left hip. She looked up at the dashing Dallas King and offered her cheek. When she stepped forward, the slit in her dress revealed a long-toned thigh. The young hostess had no idea what King did for a living, nor did she care. All she knew was he was handsome, well-dressed, and graced the trendy bistro with his presence at least once a week, and usually with a different woman. The stunning jewel had been asked out by approximately every other man who entered the establishment, and she was beginning to wonder when this one would get around to the task. As King kissed her cheek, the woman slipped her hands inside his suit coat and placed them gently just above his waistline. King felt the gentle touch of her hands on his waist, and a sexual jolt hit him straight in the groin. Letting his nose linger by her smooth skin for a second, he took in a deep breath of clean, fresh perfume. With a furtive grin, he said, "Kim, you look gorgeous, as always." The young Asian woman took the compliment with a smile and slowly removed her hands from King's hips.
"Thank you."
King stared at her for a moment, allowing her the chance to ask him the obvious question about what was going on at the White House. The moment came and went, and it dawned on King that the beauty before him was either severely hampered in the brain department, or she honestly had no idea what he did for a living. In either case, she wasn't about to run out and join the local Mensa chapter. King winked, and then made his way toward the rear of the restaurant. The bar area was crowded. The hostage crisis had given the city something to talk about. For Washington bar owners, a scandal or crisis was like a big sporting event. Several of the more astute bar patrons recognized the young Californian as Vice President Baxter's chief of staff and began to whisper as King worked his way through the crowd. As King walked past the trendy rag-rolled walls and secluded booths, he scanned the dining area for his newest infatuation. In the last booth before reaching the payphone and the bathrooms, King saw her. Sheila Dunn had her laptop open, a cell phone in one hand and a glass of wine in the other. Upon seeing King, she said into her cell phone, "He's here. I'll call you back." The 34-year-old reporter set the phone down, but kept the glass of wine securely in her grip.
"Dallas, where in the hell have you been?"
"I'm sorry." King bent down to kiss the blonde-haired woman sitting in the booth. Dunn offered her cheek and said,
"I have 15 minutes to get my story in, and my editor is about to pull my hair out."
With an angry look, she added,
"You'd better talk fast."
King sat in the booth, and as he did so, a waiter approached. Dunn held up her nearly finished glass and said,
"Two more of these,"
without bothering to say please, then turned her glare back in the direction of King.
"You're an hour late. That's a hell of a way to try and endear yourself to me."
"Excuse me," King uttered, a touch irked by her comment. "I don't know if you've noticed, but we have a bit of a crisis going on, and I'm just a touch busy right now."
"Don't patronize me, Dallas. I'm very aware of what's going on, and I have a deadline to meet. So when you say you're going to be here at a certain time and you show up an hour late without calling, don't expect me to act like one of your congenial little empty-headed bimbos."
Dunn took a deep breath and folded her arms across her chest. She had intentionally worked herself into this frenzy, figuring the more upset she was, the more likely Dallas would be to hand over some good info. This was the exact reason why King liked her. She was feisty. Most of the women he dated were great arm pieces, but they lacked something up top. Sheila Dunn was different. She wasn't knocked down gorgeous, as many of his women were, but her brains and drive made her every bit as attractive. Dunn was fairly plain-looking. She had slender features, was not curvaceous in any sense of the word, but while many women her age had already seen their best days, Dunn was just moving into hers. She had the mature confidence of a woman who would hold her beauty for years to come. And most important, she was married, something that King had seen as an obstacle for years, but now embraced as a bonus. With the married ones, it was all about sex. He didn't have to spend large amounts of money or play tiresome games. Dunn had rebuked all of King's romantic advances, but the young Dallas could tell he was wearing her down. She was one of the Post's political correspondents, and King had gotten to know her since his recent arrival in the nation's capital. As Baxter's chief of staff, King had, as one of his first priorities, to cultivate sources in the media that could be used to leak information when needed. He reached across the table and grabbed her hand. "How are things with your husband?" "Shitty," was Dunn's terse one-word reply. Rubbing her hand, he asked, "When was the last time you two slept together?" She pulled back quickly. "Dallas, that's none of your business." "Fine, you don't have to answer it, but you're far too beautiful a woman to be so lonely." "Dallas, let's change the subject." King had taken her down this road before, and he was gaining ground. Dunn was having serious doubts about her marriage. She knew that King wanted her, and she thought this might be the time to give up the jewel. This was the biggest story in 3 decades, and no one had any idea what was going on inside the White House or the FBI's command post. No one was talking. The crisis had people tight-lipped. If sleeping with King meant she could get some info out of him, it might be worth it. The drinks arrived, and King took a big sip. He let the dry Merlot run down his throat and then said, "You wouldn't believe the shit that's going on down there." Dunn leaned forward and placed her forearms on the table.
"Like what?"
Rolling his eyes, King said, "Tutwiler, that stupid bitch, she's the damn reason Schwartz and his secretary are dead. It was her stupid idea to jerk this nutbag's chain and only send him part of the money." King stopped briefly and took a sip, thinking of the warning the man from the CIA had given all of them, that Aziz would react exactly the way he did. "I tried to advise against it, but she won out. You know how she is. She took charge of the entire briefing at the Pentagon yesterday. The damn woman has the worst case of penis envy I've ever seen. She just couldn't pass up the chance to put all of those military types in their place." King stopped and shook his head. "And to make things worse, she's not around to take the heat. She had a fucking nervous breakdown after Schwartz got shot. They had to cart her off to Bethesda." Dunn's jaw hung loosely.
"You're kidding."
"No." King shook his head for emphasis. "I wish I was. I wish she was here to take the heat." King pointed to himself. "Now I'm the one who's getting squeezed." Dunn set her wine down and started tapping at the keys of her laptop.
"So, Tutwiler is out. What in the hell is the FBI up to?"
Dunn watched King shrug his shoulders and take another drink. She was going to have to work for this one.
"Come on, Dallas, just give me some good background. I'm not asking you to give away any national secrets."
Dunn paused to give him a second to think about it, and then, in a soft voice, she asked,
"What's the FBI up to?"
King looked over the top of his wine glass. "They're planning for every possible contingency, collecting information and trying to find a way out of this. Sherman has told them that unless they can guarantee getting the rest of the hostages out safely, we sit tight."
"What about the president? Is all that crap your boss spun in his address the truth?"
"He's fine," King nodded emphatically, "just like Sherman said." Then, waving his hand in the air as if the president was a non-factor, he added, "The people at the Pentagon say he can last for weeks in that bunker." King took another drink and then leaned forward. With his nose perched above the screen of Dunn's laptop, King breathed in her perfume and said, "You smell great."
Thank you, Dunn smiled half-heartedly and then got back to business. What else is going on? Do you know what their next demand is going to be?
Nope. We're not supposed to hear anything until the morning.
King's attention was drawn downward. Dunn's blouse was open one more button than normal, and a scintillating amount of soft skin was drawing his mind into a completely different area again. He looked down her shirt and said, I want to get naked with you so bad.
Dunn grabbed him by the jaw and made him look her in the eye.
This stuff you gave me about Tutwiler is good, Dallas, but there's more going on than you're telling me. And if you want to get me into bed, you're going to have to do a lot better, and fast.
King felt the blood rushing to his groin. His mind scrambled for any piece of information that might seal the deal, but he'd told her everything that was going on. The truth was, nothing was going on. Everybody was sitting around and waiting to react, except one person. King pulled away and sat back. He couldn't talk about that, but there was something related that he could talk about, something that would play great in the press.
There is one thing.
Pausing, he tried to gauge how much information he could hand over. Dunn saw his hesitancy and drew closer.
What? What is it?
King looked around the immediate area and then leaned forward.
Listen, no one can find out I told you this.
Dunn feigned insult.
Dallas, I've never revealed one of my sources.
Unimpressed, King rolled his eyes.
All I'm saying is that this is serious shit, all right?
Dunn nodded eagerly.
You have my word. Your name will never be revealed.
The vice president's chief of staff looked around once again to make sure no one was eavesdropping, and then, in a whisper, he said,
The CIA knew about this attack before it happened.
Dunn's eyes almost popped out of her head.
What? And they didn't do anything about it?
No, King shook his head. They only found out just before it happened. As soon as they found out, they alerted the Secret Service. That's why Hayes made it to his bunker.
So the CIA saved the day?
King shrugged. It was hardly a banner day, but I suppose you could say that. Dunn smiled broadly.
This could be good.
Frantically, she began typing. King watched her for about half a minute, and then Dunn closed her laptop. She packed it and her phone in her bag and said,
I've got to get this in before we go to press.
Dunn stood. She was wearing a tight blue skirt that hugged her thin frame. Leaning over the table, she grabbed King by the jaw with one hand and said,
You and I aren't done. If you keep this up, you just might wear me down.
Dunn pulled King's lips to hers and gently ran the tip of her tongue along his lower lip. She let her tongue hang there just long enough to leave him wanting more, and then turned and left. Chapter 23 Jack Warch stood by the bunker door and touched the smooth surface with the palm of his hand. It had been several hours since he had done so, and as far as he could tell, the door was getting warmer. He took that as a bad sign. Warch had been beating his brains out all day over what to do if the terrorists got the door open before the hostage rescue team intervened. He assumed from the explosion he had heard during the initial assaults that they had grenades. That would make it a short fight. He could put the president in the small bathroom on the other side of the bunker and buy maybe another 5 minutes. That would result in more dead agents and ultimately a dead or captured president. Warch plopped down on his bunk. As he exhaled a deep sigh, he saw the president coming over. Warch straightened up a bit and started to stand. Hayes gestured to him with a patting motion of his hand and said,
Don't get up. Do you mind if I sit?
Please. Said Warch as he scooted over.
You're from Wisconsin, right?
Yes, sir.
I thought so. I saw your two boys running around on the South Lawn one Saturday morning in their Packer jerseys. I figured either you or your wife was from Wisconsin.
Warch half laughed.
No, my wife's from Minnesota.
She hates it when I dress them up in the Packer gear.
She should have thought of that before she married you.
That's what I tell her.
Warch smiled.
What part of Wisconsin are you from?
Appleton.
Ah, the home of Rocky Blyer.
Yep.
I met him once, pronounced Hayes with satisfaction. What a great man. With a nod of his chin, he added, what a great story.
Yeah, he overcame a lot. The best part about him, though, is he never let any of the success go to his head. He does a ton for the local community.
That's nice to hear. Hayes looked down at the floor for a while. The idle conversation seemed to be over. Sitting on the edge of the bunk, he rested his elbows on his knees and continued to study the ugly brown carpeting. After a moment, he leaned back and glanced over at Warch.
Jack, I'm sorry about all of this. I appreciate everything you and your people have done for me and my family.
Hayes stopped and looked away. Warch waited and then said,
thank you, sir.
After several awkward moments of silence, Hayes looked at his watch. It was almost midnight.
Well, another 6 hours or so, and we'll know if they're coming to save us.
Warch nodded.
So you think they'll come tonight?
Hayes leaned back.
Well, if I know General Flood and Director Stansfield, they'll be pushing hard for it.
Hayes's mind seemed to drift, and slowly he started to shake his head.
What is it, sir?
I'm not so sure about the Vice President.
How do you mean, sir?
The President eyeballed Warch. Jack, I trust that whatever I say to you will go no further?
That goes without saying, sir.
I thought so. Hayes looked out across the bunker. Out of the side of his mouth, he said, I don't exactly trust Baxter. Hayes continued, he wasn't my first choice. Hell, he wasn't even in my top 10. The truth is, the party stuck me with him. They said he could deliver California and the big Hollywood money. You need both to win the race, so he was the man. Experience and character were never factored in. Frowning, Hayes said, I knew a week after the convention that he was the wrong man, but by then there was no turning back.
Is that why you've isolated him?
The comment surprised Hayes a bit.
You've noticed?
This is my fourth administration, sir. We're taught to keep our mouths shut, but that doesn't mean we don't see and hear everything that goes on.
All Hayes could do was nod.
Well, Baxter's the big wild card. He and Tutwiler.
Hayes shook his head again. I didn't want to have anything to do with her either, but it was all part of the deal.
What about Director Roach? He's a good man.
Yes, he is, Hayes nodded. He's one of the best, but unfortunately he answers to Tutwiler.
Warch looked over at the door and then back to his boss.
Sir, if HRT doesn't get here in time, we need to take some precautions.
Such as? Warch was short on details as he related what he thought would happen. He felt there was no sense in alarming the president over something that was out of their control. Hayes listened intently as Warch laid out his limited plan. Anna Reilly was sleeping fitfully when she was stirred by something. Just as she opened her eyes, she felt a pair of hands grab her by the shoulders. A second later, she was on her feet, face to face with the terrorist who had pulled her out of line. Reilly immediately began to lash out with her arms. The terrorist grabbed her by the throat with his right hand and squeezed tightly. The young journalist continued to flail as her eyes bulged wider as the air was squeezed from her. White spots began to dot her vision, and in one last, violent attempt to break free, Reilly rammed her knee up into her assailant's groin. The blow would have sent most men to their knees, but Abu Hassan was no normal man. Instead of buckling over, he grunted and took a half-step back. Then his right hand shot forward and caught Reilly square on the jaw. She spun like a top and went straight to the floor. The room was completely silent for the next 5 seconds. None of the hostages made a noise, and the other terrorists looked on to see what would happen next. Finally, Hassan bent over and let out a deep groan. This elicited a chorus of laughs and chuckles from the other three Arabs standing guard. Several of the women crawled from their spots to help Reilly, but before they could reach her, the terrorist stood partially upright and shouted a warning to them.
Still smarting from the knee to his groin, Abu Hassan lumbered forward, bent at the waist like an ape. Reaching down, he grabbed the unconscious Reilly and threw her over his shoulder. As he moved toward the door, he scowled at his friends who were still laughing at him. When he reached the exit, he paused long enough to tell one of the other